Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as we mentioned earlier in the week, we have begun our 30 Issues in 30 Days nominating process. You can go to our webpage and nominate an issue to be included in our presidential election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days, which will start next month. More than 100 people from coast to coast have already nominated as we partner with the Huffington Post and Instapundit.com on this, one more Obama-leaning website and one that leans more McCain. And we will hold a vote on your issues next month, and then we'll launch a 30 Issues wiki for you to help produce each of the segments. And the reason that I'm mentioning the project again right now is that our next guest is Jeff Howe, author of a new book called Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. Jeff is a contributing editor to Wired magazine. He coined the word crowdsourcing, and he has documented in this book many examples of how business and journalism and the arts are being transformed by the blurring of the line these days between professionals and amateurs and between producers and audience. He ranges through everything from Procter & Gamble product marketing to the search for extraterrestrial life, believe it or not. Our open source approach to the 30 Issues in 30 Days project this year is our latest example of crowdsourcing. Jeff Howe's book even references two of our earlier crowdsourcing projects from this show in the book. So let's talk crowdsourcing with Jeff Howe. Hi, Jeff. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for having me.
And for those who don't know the word, did you derive it from outsourcing?
Yeah, more or less. I'd spent about a year looking at what kids were doing on MySpace and looking at user-generated content. But I was convinced that it wasn't just about content. It was about something deeper. In a conversation with my editor, I said, he said, it's like outsourcing to the crowd. I said, or crowdsourcing. So that was
right.
That's the derivation.
And the funny thing is, if you're an employee, you usually think of outsourcing as a bad thing. You know, companies laying off workers so they can send their jobs overseas or to some other contractor to save money. But obviously, you don't see crowdsourcing in that context.
No, I don't. But neither do I think, if you're in Bangalore, outsourcing isn't a bad thing either. I mean, I think outsourcing is merely descriptive. I think crowdsourcing is merely descriptive. There are plenty of stock photographers that are very unhappy with crowdsourcing. It's taking money out of their wallets.
Because one of the opening examples in the book is from something called iStockPhoto.com.
Yes.
Why don't you start there?
Yes. So as of, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago, the average price of a stock photo was $250, $300. Well, now it's about $1 to look on these micro stock sites like iStockPhoto.
And what do we mean by stock photo?
A stock photo is simply a pre-shot photograph. It's sort of the dirty white lie of the publishing industry, that they can buy these much cheaper than sending a photographer out to actually take a commissioned photograph. They can just buy a pre-shot photo.
The pre-existing headshots writers and other people.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So now, so what happened? Bruce Livingstone started this iStockPhoto, and what did he do?
Well, he simply wanted, he didn't want to have to pay $250, $300. He was a web designer. He didn't always need them for expensive projects, so it was onerous overhead for him. So what he did is post his own photos online and say, hey, if anyone wants to use mine, any other web designer or print designer, all they have to do is upload their own. And so it became a site for amateur photographers. And what happened is even though this was a side project, he'd honestly just started this out of an altruistic impulse to sort of help his community. He couldn't pay the hosting costs anymore, so he started charging $0.25 for each one. So inadvertently, accidentally, he had wound up undercutting the stock photo agencies by more than 99%.
And he can make money on this?
Absolutely. They make a lot of money. Getty bought iStockPhoto for $50 million. It was the smartest thing that their CEO ever did.
Another example right from the start of the book, the T-shirt company, Threadless.com. Where does crowdsourcing meet T-shirt making?
So Threadless is my example of as pure crowdsourcing. The crowd designs the T-shirts. The crowd votes on which T-shirt should win. And what Threadless gets through this voting and sort of other functions on the site is an exact gauge of what consumer demand is. Threadless does about 90,000 T-shirts a month. They've never had overstock. They sell out of every single line because they have an exact idea of how much demand exists for each shirt.
And who makes the money on these T-shirts that the crowd designs?
Well, Threadless does, about 30% profit margin. But I have to say, no one in the community is complaining. Winners get around $2,500, and I think there are six, maybe nine winners a week. And then the community loves doing it. These are budding graphic designers, amateur graphic designers, design students, people who I think of as quasi-professionals. They're somewhere between amateurs and professionals, and they enjoy this community. They get their, they learn tips and tricks, as well as just the pleasure of socializing with like-minded peers.
So let's do a few more examples, and then we'll talk about what you think all this means, because you think it's not just a business story, but nothing less than a cultural and even psychological revolution that is defining a generation. So we'll get into that. But what's the Procter & Gamble example?
So Procter & Gamble has really opened up in a lot of neat ways, but the one that I focus on in my book is their use of a network of 140,000 scientists all around the world called InnoCentiv. So what happens is if P&G's in-house corporate R&D staff gets stumped, and this is not a small department. They employ 9,000 scientists. If they can't if they get stumped, they will post this problem to InnoCentiv, which is essentially just an internet board. And then these scientists from all around the world can look at it. And about one-third of the time, one of these 140,000 scientists will solve the problem, which is, one-third doesn't sound like a lot until you figure this stumped, in P&G's case at least, 9,000 of the best scientists in the world. Just quickly, the real insight into how InnoCentiv works is that there was a Harvard study on InnoCentiv, and they found that there's a positive correlation between distance of field and successful solutions, which means people who should have been the least successful were the most successful. The people with the least expertise in the field had the best odds of success.
Why? And fresh eyes?
Fresh eyes. That's pretty much it. At the root of crowdsourcing are a lot of ideas fundamental to collective intelligence. And those are that diversity will generally trump ability. And the reason that is that people who are very, very good tend to get very good at the same places, using the same ideas, studying the same things. Often you'll get some undergrad who will come in and say, my dad used to have this home remedy that he used, and there are real cases of this where people are applying sort of homegrown knowledge to problems that have, as I said, stumped some of the best scientists in the world.
Which goes to the quote you have in the book from Bill Joy, founder of Sun Microsystems, who said, no matter who you are, most of the smartest people in the world work for someone else.
I've said before that if you don't have time to read the book, read that quote, and you've basically read the book.
And if you don't have time to read the book, you can at least listen to this interview as it continues with Jeff Howe, author of the book Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. And our phones and comment page are open, 212-433-WNYC, or go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. You got to tell us about crowdsourcing and the search for extraterrestrial life. There's a popular screensaver in this story and a Guinness Book of World Records mark that they call the largest computation in history.
That's right.
What does this have to do with aliens?
Well, so SETI, or the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, was a project started by some Berkeley scientists who essentially wanted to take the load off their computers in the lab and distribute it to people all around the world. And they had no idea how successful it would be. Their aim was, at the very high end, to get 100,000 people to download this screensaver, which, essentially how it works is when you walk away from your computer and it goes to sleep, it will download a packet of information that has been generated by a radio telescope in Puerto Rico, and it will analyze that information to see if they can pick up any signals that would be sent from another planet, intelligent life on another planet. So basically, they're looking for the Brian Lehrer Show on Mars or whatnot. And
we're looking for it too. We'll do a remote program from there when we find it. We'll do a co-host thing.
What wound up happening is 5 million people downloaded this little device. I mean, it's a very tiny program onto their computers. And as you said, Guinness considers it the largest computation in history. But the lesson here, because that isn't necessarily crowdsourcing per se, but it's the model for crowdsourcing. crowdsourcing. They call it distributed computing. And what crowdsourcing is distributed labor. It's large numbers of people accomplishing tasks that would either stump or overwhelm small numbers of people.
By the way, did you see the sushi story on the front page of the Times today? Two New York City high school students took DNA samples from their local sushi restaurant, or a few sushi restaurants, and sent them to a lab to be analyzed, and found that a quarter of the fish they tested were mislabeled. Like the fancy white tuna sushi they tested turned out to be the much cheaper Mozambique tilapia. Is that crowdsourcing or is that something else?
I would not call it crowdsourcing, although I loved that story and I did read it. But, it becomes crowdsourcing as soon as, say, a federal agency says, hey, these tests exist. In the story it mentioned, the high school student's dad had said, soon people will have these like GPS handheld devices. They can just test as soon as a federal agency says, we're going to
DNA. Readers, handheld DNA readers,
exactly. As soon as people start doing it for the agency, yes, that's crowdsourcing.
And here's how far you go with what this all means to society. And this is where it gets even more interesting to me. But tell me if you can really back this up. You're right. Threadless and iStock Photo are part of a first wave of a business and cultural revolution that will change how we think about the internet, commerce, and most importantly, ourselves, unquote. Now, cultural revolution is a strong term, Jeff, as Chairman Mao was telling me just the other day. And to claim that crowdsourcing is changing how we think of ourselves takes its impact way beyond the business world and into the realm of social psychology.
Yeah. Yeah, I spent 2 years looking closely at this, and obviously to assert that someone who's never heard of the word crowdsourcing has never been to iStockPhoto or been to Threadless, that their psychology is being changed by crowdsourcing would be a branch I wouldn't want to go out on. But I would say that for anyone that would qualify as a digital native, which we can think of as anyone who's never picked up a newspaper but only gets their news online, more or less someone born after 1980. And anyone who has really learned to flourish in an environment of online communities, then yes, absolutely. I not only think that the culture is changing, but I think that the economy is changing as well.
I think Mark Prensky is the guy who coined that term, digital natives and digital immigrants.
That's right.
Flesh that out a little bit.
Well, so basically his idea was that this generation gap is as significant and meaningful as the generation gap that separated the boomers and their parents. But that instead of it being about music or pursuing a libertine lifestyle, it is instead about how these kids use the technology. To confirm, I mean, he believes that this is, that this is almost a singularity in the words of Ray Kurzweil. And to see what I thought, I spent some time at some cyber camps around the city last summer, and I wound up absolutely agreeing with him. If you look at the way a 17 or an 8-year-old right now interacts with technology, it's so fundamentally different from the way that even I do. I mean, I'm 38, but I work at Wired Magazine. I mean, I am, as relatively speaking, pretty tech savvy. Nothing like these people. And the example I use is that for them, the technology is no longer interesting. For us, it never stops being the story. For them, it's like a pencil. It's boring. It's only the means to an end. People my age are still trying to figure out what a wiki is. They don't care what a wiki is. They use it instinctively.
This is what I want to open up the phones on. And for people born 1980 or later, does this make sense to you? Are you just wired differently? Our guest from Wired Magazine is saying you are psychologically wired differently from your parents because of the nature of your interaction with technology as a digital native compared to a digital immigrant. Does this make sense to you? Call us up, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Born 1980 or later. And by the way, welcome to any of you who are hearing the show for the first time because you just moved to New York to go to college, right? College starts probably next week in most schools. And if you're in that group and you were looking for your public radio station or just stumbled upon us as you went up and down the dial or local websites or whatever, hi. And call us 212-433-WNYC. 833-9692, and the calls are lighting up. But while they go through our screener, another example that I found really interesting along these lines, you quote Henry Jenkins, author of the book Convergence Culture, on the nature of creativity changing. And he says, in an open source culture based on sampling and appropriation, creativity involves working within a social network and negotiating cultural differences. That's his quote. And that's a very different notion of creativity than I think the traditional one of the painter or the novelist working at home alone in their studio.
Well, you know, before I had come up with the term crowdsourcing, really the inspiration for it was spending a summer on the Warp Tour, the Vans Warp Tour, with all these punk rock bands and skaters and tattoo artists and poets and illustrators and artists. And what I noticed was that they were what I thought of as promiscuously creative or medium agnostic. They painted and played music, but they weren't doing it to become painters or musicians. They were just doing stuff. They were just incredibly creative, and it was in a much more sort of native expressionistic mode than I think people of other generations are used to.
All right, let's take a break, and we'll come back and take some of these phone calls. My guest is Jeff Howe, author of Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. WNYC with Jeff Howe from Wired Magazine, author of Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. And we'll take some of the calls that are coming in from people born 1980 or later who he says are just wired differently because of your native relationship with technology rather than older folks' immigrant relationship with technology. But just let me ask you, do you see this as a business book? Because again, the subtitle of the book I'm sorry, I lost it here for a second. It's Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. So, do you feel you've written mostly a business book here, a guide to making money off the enthusiasm of the public for doing things ourselves?
I hope not. Honestly, I think that there are certain pressures to fit within categories when it comes to selling books. When it comes to writing them, I think you just take your ideas and your reporting and you sit down and go. I don't know. It's definitely not a guide to making money. There is, the last chapter are the 10 rules of crowdsourcing. And that's where I do try to be normative and say, this is how it works. This is how it doesn't work. But really, I approach the other 11 chapters as a journalist, first and foremost. These were my observations. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. But I am saying it's a robust thing, and it's on the rise, and it's going to affect more and more aspects of our culture, and it's important to pay attention to.
Bradley of Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hey, Bradley, thanks for calling in.
No problem, Brian. I do think there is a generational gap, and I would categorize it by this one question that my parents sometimes ask me, and that is, is that something I can do online? Which is a question that is just something, I mean, there's a disconnect there, which is, I just don't even think about it. Of course you can do it online. You can order food, you can look up a phone number, you can do whatever you need to do. And it's just that basic, I think.
That's a great example. I had not heard that particular one before, but I think it goes to the root of what we're saying, right? Is that
right?
You don't. It's. I mean, that's almost how you could define the difference between digital native and digital immigrant. Is that if you have to have a conscious thought of, gee, could I use technology to do that? Then
exactly.
You're probably a digital immigrant.
That's just the point I was trying to make.
Bradley, when were you born?
1984.
Right. And is there a value judgment that goes with this at all?
I don't think so. I mean, I always sort of roll my eyes at them whenever I hear that question asked. But I just think it's something that I accept, like, it's not native to them. And even as I'm getting older, I feel like I'm starting to fall behind. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't use Twitter, I don't use Dig, and I barely even really know what these things are. So I sort of see where they're coming from.
Bradley, thanks a lot for your call. And by the way, I can now announce, this is the first announcement of this, though you can't sign up for it quite yet, I don't think. I will be distributing a Twitter feed from the Democratic and Republican conventions. So soon you'll be able to sign up via our website. But yes, I'm going to tweet Denver and tweet St. Paul. And I think it's going to be, I think we're going to get good content there. But Rafi in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rafi.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
So I guess I really wanted to just push back on the idea of digital natives versus digital immigrants.
Yes.
I'm an educational professional. I work with young people all the time in technology programs. And what I find is that, you quoted, your guest quoted Henry Jenkins. And Jenkins talks about something called the participation gap. And the participation gap is basically kind of the new version of the digital divide, where you have some people and some kids that are really attuned to what's going on and are mentored. And you've got a lot more, actually, usually from lower socioeconomic groups and disadvantaged groups, that basically are never given full access, whether it's because they don't have computers in the home or they only access it in the library and they can't download files or certain sites are blocked. You're really experiencing a very different kind of shift generationally, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges right now.
Jeff?
Yeah, he's absolutely right. I mean, Jenkins is, in fact, I'll be honest, I pull some of Jenkins' insights that work in my context of how this demographic is different without having the space, unfortunately, in my book to really get into his larger concern, which is exactly what you just said, which is that, you know, people think of digital divide of like, oh, well, it's conquered because people in this housing project are now all online. But that's not if their schools are keeping them from going to YouTube, if they're blocking them off of YouTube or MySpace or Facebook, if they're not giving them digital cameras, if they're not teaching them photo editing software, then the digital divide hasn't lessened. It's actually gotten larger. And this is a real concern, and it was actually heartbreaking to me that I actually got taken out in edits from my book because it wasn't quite in the scope of what I was writing about.
Rafi, thank you for that. Doug Rushkoff, who's a regular guest here, talks about exactly that same thing too.
Yeah.
The different digital divide than people actually think of. It's not just about having online access or having a computer.
I don't want to harp on it, but it's even more insidious because it's invisible. People think the digital divide has gone away, but the participation divide, as Jenkins rightly calls it, is larger, and it's actually, I think, going to be having an even more deleterious effect on all of us.
Joe in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. I just wanted to highlight some problems that I find with being so reliant on all this technology. I graduated. I'm a fine arts major, and it used to be that you would send people mix CDs or you'd have a pen pal, and you would sort of leave this paper trail behind. And I'm just worried sort of that my generation is not going to have that. You know, we're not going to have that. All these concrete, tangible things to return to, and I just wanted to get your guest comments on that.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember I hadn't thought about that much before. Wired did an infographic on the longevity of different mediums, and the longevity has decreased over time. So the mediums with the most longevity are like papyrus and stone, and then we get to paper, and then we get to audio tape, and then we get to CDs, which now we have these formats. I mean, you're absolutely right. Is archiving is actually a really big subject for people that follow these kinds of things. It's a problem. I mean, I have emails from 10 years ago that I'll never be able to open, and I know it's ridiculous. I keep them, but I want those emails, to say nothing of my music and my photos and everything else.
Thank you, Joe. Anusha and Ramsey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anusha.
Hi. This is Anusha, and I was thinking about Facebook and how my parents don't understand how important that social network is, and it's such a nice way of getting involved, and now I'm going off to college, and it's just a way to get to know everyone before I actually go to college, and they feel like it's not a useful tool, but it actually is, and it helps you show your feelings as well. So I was wondering what you thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that cuts to the heart of what we're talking about. Is it's all too easy for a parent to read stories about how, you know, the California teen hung herself after a neighbor mom made up a boy who then dumped her, and think like, oh my God, you are not going on these sites without understanding. And you don't understand unless you actually not. I mean, you can't just create a Facebook profile and be like, okay, well, I get Facebook. It's not about that. It's spending time on Facebook, establishing a network, and watching how that network interacts, and understand that you have these feeds and these games you play. You can play, you know, I won't even get into it. I mean, thousands of different applications within it. To understand that it has as much use as orientation used to. It's probably, I would argue that Facebook may be as or more important than orientation in most colleges.
You mean freshman orientation?
Yeah, sorry, freshman orientation.
Yeah, which is exactly, Anusha, how you said you're using it to some degree. How are you finding, out of all the people in your freshman class, how are you figuring out who to actually talk to on Facebook?
Well, there are a lot of message boards on Facebook, and you just have to figure out which titles actually apply to you. And so if you go through that and search through it, you'll probably find a lot of people who are interested in the same things that you are. And through that, you can make friends off of that and just grow a relationship with the people online.
Hey, good luck in college.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. We have just a few minutes left with Jeff Howe from Wired Magazine, author of Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. And I want to ask you, because you obviously see crowdsourcing as a positive thing, but you do also write that, was, as with any major cultural shift, there will be upheaval and disruption. Where do you see it?
Well, we're seeing it now in stock photography because it's you know, without boring your listeners with actual, you know, numbers, stock charts, it's really transformed that industry, and it's having an effect on journalism. It's having an effect on graphic design. The question I pose in the book is stock photography the canary in the coal mine? That, you know, less an isolated example than an indication of what's to come. You know, I see crowdsourcing as a net positive because I think it's going to liberate a lot of latent talent and creativity among people who, for either geographical or socioeconomic reasons, have not been able to express it before, capitalize on it. You know, I do. I don't find disruption to be theoretical and interesting. I know people. I am now friends with people, certainly in the music industry, which has been my beat for years, you know, have lost their livelihoods. That's very painful. I have kids. I mean, I relate to this. I sometimes say I'm worried that I'm documenting my own obsolescence. I mean, is the crowd going to take my job? Maybe.
And RC from Queens writes on our comments page, what concerns me is that we will be raising a generation that will think that building the next big thing or creating the next idea is someone else's problem, that all they will have to do is throw up their problem on the internet.
I don't know. You know, like any good journalist, it's difficult to speculate too far out. But, you know, suffice to say there are problems with this. I mean, you know, lots of bugs to be worked out, that's for sure.
All right. Jeff Howe from Wired Magazine, his new book, Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. It's published by Crown Business. Great conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we'll stay technological briefly and take your calls on the most inappropriate text message you've ever received. We will play one listener's horror story. And then we'll talk about whether South Ossetians are really Russian or not. I may have made a mistake about that earlier in the week. And we'll look at this new deal between the Bush administration and the Iraqi government for a timeline, yes, timeline, for withdrawal of troops. Stay with us.